What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Hidden Forces with me, Dimitri Kafinas. Today, I speak with Lacey Hunt, Executive Vice President of Hoisington Investment Management Company, a registered investment advisor specializing in fixed income portfolios with over $3 billion under management. For nearly 14 years, Dr. Hunt was Chief U.S. Economist for HSBC Group, one of the world's largest banks. He was also Executive Vice President and Chief Economist at Fidelity, and also held the position of Senior Economist for the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. Debt deflation, poor demographics, a historically low savings rate, rising inequality, falling productivity, and the financialization of the global economy. How do all of these phenomena derive from a single economic force, the persistent willingness of governments to bail out financial markets time and again, flooding the banking system with cheap money by bidding up asset prices at the expense of the broader economy? This is a conversation full of data, statistics, and econometrics. Bank lending, money velocity, monetary aggregates, disposable income, liquidity coverage ratios, and credit spreads. But it is also a story about how we manage, despite the warnings of history, to repeat the blunders of economies past, replacing credit for capital and liability for effort. How will we navigate the next recession, having wasted the last 8 years chasing the shadows of wealth through buybacks, stock appreciation, and financialization? Where will the demand come from in a consumer-led economy with diminishing savings rates and rising interest expenses? What about our unfunded liabilities, mortgage payments, rents, and college tuitions? And how does all this tie back into the resurgence of populism and the escalation of geopolitical tensions in a world tied together by our liabilities but torn apart by the specter of conflict, the failures of diplomacy, and the expediency of war? As always, you can gain access to reading lists put together by me ahead of every episode by visiting the show's website at hiddenforcespod.com. Lastly, if you are listening to the show on iPhone or Android, make sure to subscribe. If you like the show, write us a review. And if you want a sneak peek into how the show is made, or for special storylines told through pictures and questions, then like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Hidden Forces Pod. And now, let's get right to this week's conversation. Dr. Hunt, welcome to Hidden Forces.
Great to be with you.
It's great having you in the studio. So I wanted to have you on the program. As I said to you, I believe I saw you at Grant's conference speak. I go to Grant's regularly whenever I can. But I'm also familiar with your work, particularly in demographics and looking at structural demographic issues. And that's something that I particularly want to focus on today, because it's something that we haven't had a chance to cover on the program. But I think we have enough time to really get into everything. And I want to sort of preface our conversation for the audience by saying that this, to me, I'll give you sort of unleash my bias, what I sort of think and how I see things. I feel that we're living in the aftermath of the failures, the unrealized failures of 2008. I think since that time, since 2008, the monetary authorities and governments and central banks did what they could to sort of minimize the impact of asset price deflation and coddled the financial industry at the expense of the broader economy. And what we're seeing today are sort of the perverse effects of all that, which is what I wanted to get into with you, not just in the U.S., but I think China. We've covered China on the program. Europe has suffered greatly as a result of these types of policies. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about your approach, how you view the world, how you begin to think about all this stuff, and sort of what your take on this is?
Well, I think that the debt process really traces back before 2008. 2008 was the first serious manifestation that too much debt is adversarial to economic growth. But the debt had been rising in the government sector and in the non-financial sector very dramatically since the early 1980s. And so the problems were building. I think that in even some of the underlying origins occur before 1980.
Like what? I mean, can you give us some examples?
One, when Nixon closed the gold window.
71.
Whenever policy mistakes were made in the period where we had to meet foreign official demand for gold, the dollar would come under attack, and the foreign exchange markets would then give a signal to the policymakers that they were veering off course. Mm. And once the dollar was freely floating, then there was no policy signal. And so the politicians were free, politicians, both parties, to continue to accumulate debt.
You're talking about Bretton Woods, the system that was loosely tied to gold after World War II.
Yeah, but it was tied enough so that when there was a problem, gold would leave the country. And I think we had a chance in the early 80s to make the floating rate system work. And there was an effort by a large number of economists to force a constitutional amendment to the Constitution that would have required a 60% vote to override a balanced budget. In other words, it had to be a clear emergency of some kind.
That's a balanced budget amendment.
Yeah, a balanced budget amendment. It passed the House and the Senate. Reagan was president at the time. He supported it, but it did not get the two-thirds vote to go to the various states to ratify. And so since that time, the debt levels have risen very dramatically. And that happens to coincide with when the peak in interest rates occurred. It's not entirely that reason. But debt, we have to understand, is an increase in current spending in exchange for a decline in future spending, unless the debt generates an income stream to repay principal and interest. And what we're veering to is more and more consumptive type debt, debt that does not generate that income stream. Debt is not a solution any longer.
Let's talk about debt a second here. Let's see if we can have a philosophical conversation around what it is, because it gets thrown around a lot as a word. And I don't think people have an accurate view of it or have at the very least contemplated it. How would you define debt for our audience? What debt is?
Well, debt can be an obligation of any type in the private or the governmental sector. It requires a prepayment of a forward payment of principal and interest. And to be effective in stimulating economic activity, it has to be used very judiciously. Let me give you an example. Of course, I'm a macroeconomist. I studied macroeconomics, my main specialty. But in the course of my academic career, I also took some courses in consumer finance, business finance, state and local finance. And the stodgy old professors in consumer, business, and state and local finance taught financial integrity. And they made it very clear that if you become heavily indebted, you can create a ruinous situation for the family, for an individual firm, big or small, and even for state and local governments. But in the day, back in the day, there was a Keynesian exemption for the federal government, that there the government could borrow money and spend it for whatever reason, and you would increase the GDP by $4 or $5. Now it is very painfully clear that there is no Keynesian exemption for macroeconomies, that any type of federal spending at this stage of the game, whether it's for tax cuts, infrastructure program, Affordable Care Act, whatever, if it's debt financed, you will not boost GDP. You can improve individual components of the overall economy.
Give us some of those numbers. You're talking about sort of the return on credit that you get for every dollar of GDP.
Well, I have run statistical tests looking at the relationship between real GDP per capita and real government debt per capita since 1950, everything excluding the World War II period, which is clearly exceptional, because government spending was a record share of economic activity and it constituted the largest share. But from 1950 forward, which is 76 years, long period of time, the coefficient is slightly negative. It's like negative 0.04, which means that if you engage in a dollar of debt financing, you will shrink the GDP by $1.04.
You're talking about the fiscal side here. Fiscal spending.
On the fiscal side.
Right.
And the coefficient, you could, if you want to be, look at it in a general sense, what it basically means is the coefficient is essentially zero. In 1821, the great economist David Ricardo, who gave us diminishing returns and comparative advantage, basically said that it was zero. And now we're at that situation. The debt financing is not going to benefit economic activity.
One of the things that you hear often with respect to debt is that it doesn't really matter. You can just kind of cancel debts out and it's no big deal. I think there is a lack of understanding, I think, also for people around how significant the effect of debt is in creating structural changes in an economy. How significant do you think the growth of private sector debt financing and consumer debt and everything, the total debt that we've seen in the economy since the early 80s, has been in restructuring the way that this economy operates so that it becomes exceedingly difficult to return to something that is more capital financed?
Well, the consumer sector is of the greatest concern to me. Since 1900, the personal saving rate, which would be household income from all sources, including transfer payments, less taxes, interest payments, and adjusted for or divided by total personal income, is currently 3.1%. Historically, since 1900, we've averaged about 8.5%. And all of this saving appears to be in the top quintile. Consumers have been living considerably beyond their means because income is not rising enough and at a fast enough pace to generate a higher standard of living. But our people still have aspirations. But the combination of the weak income growth and the low saving rate suggests to me that this is going to cause major changes going forward.
And these are trends that we've been seeing for a while, for decades now.
But
and they've been covered by debt.
And some of these patterns are becoming evident. But there's two things that have me concerned the most. We have millions of households that want to send their children to college. That's the American dream, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they neither have the income nor saving to do so. Now, the debt option is still available to them. But the income growth, the longer-term secular trends in income growth that we're witnessing are so weak that if the debt is taken on, those loans are going to need to be paid off for the next 30 years, maybe longer. And so they're going to have to be very, very hard choices made concerning college education. Another element that's in the mix is that the percentage of households that are able to buy the beloved family home mm-hmm. is going to be a more and more difficult choice. And so these sort of elements, the problem originated by taking on more and more and successively levels of debt. Each successive cycle, we paid off some of the debt, but we never got back to the original levels. And so now the option to use debt is still believed to be a successful alternative, but it is not.
So can we talk a little bit about the impact of bailing out the creditors, not just consumer credit, but I mean credit extended by financial institutions, that this has been a practice that we've engendered over and over again in a capitalist system without the capacity to fail on the credit side? What does that do in terms of restructuring the economy again? Because for me, that I see that across so many areas, and we'll get into some of these more specific examples, but how significant is that as a driver for where we are today, in particular with the gross levels of wealth and income disparity in the country?
Well, there was a very famous economist at MIT. His name was Charles Kindleberger. Wrote 19 or 20 books in economics, one of which was Manias, Panics, and Crashes, classic book.
We actually had Robert Johnson on the program of Soros fame, who learned under Charles Kindleberger, and we talked about that.
I had an acquaintance with Kindleberger myself, mm-hmm. and Kindleberger said that when you have a debt crisis, you have two options. You can resort to heroic efforts, or you can let it burn out.
Mm.
Now, we actually have one notable case of where we became extremely over-indebted. That was in 1860s and early 1870s. We were building the railroads and multiple transcontinental railroads, feeder lines, and industries that and then there was overspeculation and overinvestment. The panic year was 1873. There was no option for heroic effort.
The National Bank Act, but there was no Federal Reserve.
There was no central bank,
right.
And there was no support for not balancing the budget. And so we had a very, very difficult time, a deflationary period, that lasted about 20 years.
1873 to 1893.
Well, thereabouts. And even maybe a little bit intermittently beyond that.
And that was an epic. The period of the railroad boom is an epic period in financial history.
Yeah, it was the panic year was 1873. Grant was president. He has no idea what has hit him. It was very similar to the massive buildup of debt in the 1820s and 30s. That was the steamship lines, the canals, the early railroads, then overinvestment, overconsumption. The panic year was 1938. Van Buren is president. He has no idea what's hit him. We have 11 difficult years. Van Buren gets bailed out by the discovery of gold in California, which finances the Westward expansion. The 1850s is our best decade of peacetime growth.
Because that would have been the equivalent, I'm sorry to interrupt, but because of the fact that the world was operating on a gold standard, that was like not printing your own money, but that was actually finding money that was buried somewhere.
Yes, and it also produced extraordinary income gains, and people lived within their means because they had been burned. And they paid down the debt of the 1820s and 30s.
I'm familiar with the case also of Spain during the 1500s when the inflation that occurred in Spain as a result of the conquistadores in Latin America mm-hmm. finding all that gold. Although they had massive amounts of inflation. I don't know how if they had the same level.
But that was without a debt buildup.
Which is why they had the inflation.
And basically you got more and more inflation and undermined productivity, the wealthier classes became extremely lethargic, and that's a really different situation. Mm. But to go back to this example in 1873, there was no heroic response. But it was done in 17 to 20 years. Well, Japan became extremely over indebted in 1989. And what have they done? One heroic measure after another. There's so many different programs that people have lost track. I used to keep track, count.
The heroic measures, in your definition, are the monetary and fiscal authorities.
In other words, that's what Kendallberger. In other words, we're government policy. People are hurting, and government policy steps forward to try to shorten the time span.
Well, Japan is a very instructive case, right?
Well, just compare the 1873, no heroic effort, with Japan. Heroic efforts now since 1989. Well, if Japan had done nothing, as we did by necessity after 1870, they'd be out of the problem. But they're not out of the problem. The debt levels continue to reach new peaks.
So except in Japan's case, just to preface this to draw this distinction for the audience, this was a problem of private debt, correct? The private sector in Japan had taken on a tremendous level.
It started in the private sector, but then it became a public debt problem.
As a result of the heroic efforts that we're describing
correct.
There. And, of course, the general criticism on the mainstream community is that the Japanese didn't respond fast enough. But you've also made the case before, I believe, that the Fed did what it had to do in terms of bailing out the economy as lender of last resort, that it had to do that. But then subsequently, all the policies after that were the problems. Just when we're talking about Japan, how does that figure in terms of Japan? Because the argument there is that they didn't start fast enough. And I know we're in a slippery slope here as well, right? And I want to make that point that out, which is we're talking about a system that has many faults to it, and we're trying to sort of deal with problems that emerge from a poorly designed financial system. So I just want to preface that as well, but go ahead.
Well, here's the bottom line. Japan basically failed, and we have basically failed because an indebtedness problem is not going to be solved by taking on more debt. And if you look at the extensive work done by McKinsey Global Institute, what they show of these 24 cases of advanced economies that become over-indebted, and there's a passage of enough time so that they can trace the problem to solution, McKinsey indicates that in all cases, The problem had to be solved by a sustained period of austerity, which is a multi-year rise in the saving rate. You're not going to be able to solve an indebtedness problem by taking on more debt. Mm. You just push the problem further and further into the future while sacrificing growth and a whole lot of other things.
Let's talk about how that impacts demographics and how demographics impact that, how that's a feedback loop. One of the interesting, I actually printed out a few charts here. I wanted to draw some comparisons, and I grouped some nations together. I grouped the United States, the UK, France, Germany, and Switzerland together. But then I also looked at some countries like Italy, Spain, Greece. Greece's fertility rate in particular was shocking. It has dropped tremendously during the period of the crisis. That only compounds existing demographic problems. The Japanese have the worst demographics of any industrialized nation. How do demographics factor into this discussion?
Well, the deterioration in demographics is a symptom, and it is caused by the over-indebtedness which weakens growth. But demographics then produce their own effects. When you have less population growth, we have a baby bust in this country right now. Our fertility rate's at an all-time low. We have a household formation bust. Babies are expensive. Households are also expensive. They're conducive to growth. And one of the things that people do not realize, that if you go back to the 60s and early 70s, population growth in Japan was faster than in the United States. And as they went down this debt path to higher and higher levels of debt, the Japanese population has now turned negative. Well, it's weaker than in the U.S.
There's some visual charts of the Japanese population. 1950 was effectively a pyramid, and the projections for 2050 are an inverted pyramid in terms of the base being the very old. In fact, I think there's a statistic that says that there are more diapers now sold to old people in Japan than there are to babies.
Not aware of that, but
it's quite a visual.
The demographics are a symptom of the over-indebtedness. The deterioration in productivity is a symptom, but then it has consequences in itself. Extreme over-indebtedness, where you have too much debt, too much of the wrong type of debt, does not generate an income stream. You also cause a decline in the velocity of money.
Mm.
And when that happens, and by the way, money velocity now is at the lowest level since 1949.
We've discussed this issue a bit with a number of our guests in the past, in particular with Chris Cole, when we discussed volatility and in the specter of inflation. Why don't you tell our audience a little bit about what money velocity, how it's measured, and what the impact of that is on the economy and on inflation and deflation?
Well, money velocity, how it's measured is not critical to understanding velocity. The equation of exchange said that nominal GDP is equal to money times velocity. Velocity picks up if you're generating an income stream to repay principal and interest, velocity will rise over time. Now, velocity is in fact a very complex variable, and it's determined by many, many factors. But the most important of which, in my view, is the productivity of the debt. And so when you become over-indebted, then velocity falls.
It's also a measure of economic activity in a way, right?
Well, it picks up the shadow banking system. Mm. Between what's happening to the rate of growth in money and the rate of growth in velocity, you've covered it all.
Mm-hmm.
And if there are great innovations taking place in financial transactions and so forth and so on, and new ideas, and people say they are, well, that's fully captured in the velocity of money.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is that we know that these new ideas and concepts are being put to work, but still velocity has fought. In 1997, when velocity peaked, $1 of M2 growth resulted in $2.12 of GDP growth. In the latest quarter, $1 of M2 growth generates only $1.43. And velocity has, if you look at the data going back to 1900, you will see that velocity peaked in 1918. The debt levels went higher, much higher after 1918, but the velocity fell for almost a decade before the Great Depression. And velocity fell from 1997 till 2008, a substantial decline, then continued falling lower.
Mm-hmm.
And so once you've undermined the velocity, then monetary policy is really asymmetric. Mm-hmm. Monetary policy, when the Fed tightens in a highly leveraged economy, a little bit of tightening goes a long way. But when they ease in a highly leveraged economy, mm-hmm. and the velocity of money is declining and the interest rates are close to the zero bound, then a lot of Fed action produces very little benefit to the economy.
What has been the impact of the Fed's recent tightening and the unwinding of the balance sheet on the yield curve and the distribution of interest over time?
Well, we're seeing that effect. What folks need to understand is that the short-term rates are determined by the intersection of the demand and supply for short-term credit. And while the Federal Reserve has to work with whatever the demand for credit is, they have enough control over the monetary base that they can basically set the short rates. But when the Federal Reserve raises the federal funds rate, they don't say rise federal funds rate abracadabra. What they have to do is they have to shrink the monetary base, and that shifts the credit supply curve inward, and it catches the downward sloping demand for credit curve at a higher interest rate. And so the rate goes up, the monetary base, which is it's sitting at the base of the inverted pyramid, which is the U.S. financial system.
You're talking about the money multiplier effectively, right? The base is the money that's created by open market operations at the Fed by purchasing, let's say, treasuries or whatever they do. That's the base money that they cannot contract further. Everything else is effectively built off of loans, off of credit extended.
But so M2 is equal to the base times the money multiplier. But when you're extremely over-indebted, the money multiplier falls.
Hmm.
It fell during the 20s and 30s. And we're falling again.
Because there's a level of saturation. I mean, there are multiple variables that you're touching on here that affect, that break that multiplier, one of which is when you have taken on too much debt, you're not looking to take on any
more. That is correct. And you also don't, the banks don't have the capital. They may have the reserves to take the debt on, but taking on debt exposes bank capital.
Mm-hmm.
And so the money multiplier fell in 2008 from roughly 8, which was its 100-year average, down to 2.6 right now. 3.6.
Me wonder, now that you say that, it makes me think about Dodd-Frank and the implications of some of the capital buffer requirements in that legislation. How does that affect this unwind?
Well, the Dodd-Frank legislation, the banks have to operate under the Federal Reserve Act of 37. And under the Federal Reserve Act of 37, you just have to maintain reserves on your deposits. But the Dodd-Frank legislation requires that the banks, the large banks, the one with extreme international exposure, they have to have a 100% liquidity coverage ratio. And the liquidity coverage ratio means that they must have enough in liquidity to cover the gross outflow during the stress test period. So one of the things that's happened, if you look at excess reserves, there appear to be sufficient excess reserves, but that doesn't take in this sidebar legislation, which demands a 100% liquidity coverage ratio. Some folks said when the Fed started tightening that the banks would continue lending, but there was this other constraint.
Because they were looking at the excess reserves, and they were saying there's plenty of money.
They're only thinking about it in the traditional sense, that the banks are totally controlled by the 37 Act. And so the federal funds rate went up, and the demand, the key credit aggregates peaked within 4 or 5 weeks of the first Fed tightening in December of 2015. Mm. At that point in time, bank loans and non-financial paper peaked at around 8% growth rate, and currently we're under 4%.
So we've seen a steep drop in bank lending.
Yes, we have. And by the way, in the latest 12 months, the very critical commercial and industrial loan category is virtually unchanged. Virtually unchanged. And also, Of course, loans are on the asset side of the bank balance sheet. Deposits on the liability side, they're part of money supply. And so what has happened is money supply growth has been cut from 7% per annum to 4% per annum, and the velocity of money is still falling. Mm-hmm. So what you have today is you have a rise in the federal funds rate, the monetary base is contracting, the rate of growth in the monetary and credit aggregates is slowing dramatically, and the yield curve is inverting, which is indicative that monetary restraint is well entrenched in the financial system. And what typically happens is that this process develops before it becomes apparent in the economic indicators, but it always becomes.
These are leading indicators that
you're looking at. It's a leading indicator.
So when you look at these indicators and you sort of project forward, what are you looking at? Do you have a time horizon that you're looking at for the, because recessions come and they always come. There's no way that you can't have a recession. We are long overdue in terms of historically for a recession. I think we're 120 months past
due
or something.
We have an advanced stage expansion. Hmm. An advanced state where we've run 100 months. This is a poor expansion, but it's long running. Late stage expansions are different because pent-up demand is exhausted. When you have a steep recession, people don't buy new plant, they don't buy automobiles, they don't buy houses.
Because they've already bought them.
They bought them, and we have a large stock of new motor vehicles. We got a transitory lift because a lot of vehicles were destroyed by the natural disasters. But we have the pent-up demand for automobiles is saturated. The two clearest areas where pent-up demand is exhausted is in apartments and retail properties. Apartment construction was the strongest component of this recovery. There were time periods when it was growing 50 to 60%. But now we have overbuilt in a lot of markets, and rents on apartments are starting to come down. And apartment construction is falling. And we're also beginning to see very large increases in vacancy of storefronts, strip centers, shopping malls. Some of this may be changes in the way we buy things, but the retailers are doing poorly. And so we're not going to have a renewed bound. And here is one important area which I think is being overlooked. There is this argument that, well, at least we have capital spending. Mm-hmm. Well, if capital spending is going to be surging ahead, why are commercial and industrial loans unchanged in the last 12 months? Also, why is there a need for a lot of new capital stock when in the manufacturing sector we're operating at 75% of capacity, when typically in a late-stage expansion we're at 79% of capacity? And so the pent-up demand appears to be exhausted, and monetary and fiscal policy have very limited capabilities.
What are you looking for? I mean, these are forward indicators, like you said. These are leading indicators to other economic indicators that the Fed looks at when they decide whether they're going to loosen or not. How are you positioning your firm and yourself, and do you have a time horizon that you're looking at? Do you have a probability function that you can express sort of qualitatively?
Well, let me just say something that I think the Fed is really almost ignoring, except at the staff level, the variables which they themselves control, the reserve aggregates, the monetary aggregates, the credit aggregates, the velocity of money.
No, they pollute their own indicators.
They are basically focused on the Phillips curve. Mm. And the Phillips curve, in my view, is not valid empirically nor theoretically.
Let's give our audience a definition of what the Phillips curve is.
The Phillips curve says that as the unemployment rate goes down, the rate of increase in wages rises. But that only happens if you assume that people are fooled by the difference between change in nominal and real wages. Once you test the relationship between the unemployment rate and the Phillips curve, you see that there is no relationship.
And that was first challenged in the 70s, wasn't it, with this calculation?
Yes, by Professor Edmund Phelps at Columbia and by Milton Friedman, independent papers. And if you run all the data from 600 observations since 1965, you will see there's no Phillips curve relation. Now, a lot of the staff folks at the Board of Governors will say, well, You've got aggregation problems, lead and lag problems. And once those are cleared up, the Phillips curve will come forward. Well, I say, okay, but in the meantime, until you're able to solve the aggregation problems and the lead and lag problem, it should not be used. Mm-hmm. And I think that probably one of our greatest Federal Reserve chairmen was Paul Volcker. Volcker used to give what was called the anti-Phillips curve lecture. To me, if you look at aggregate demand and aggregate supply, what you see is that to get inflation, the aggregate demand curve shifts upward. It cuts the upward sloping aggregate supply at a higher price level. But to lift the aggregate demand curve, you have to move it up by either increasing money supply or experiencing a rise in velocity. So Arthur Burns, who was chairman of the Fed when I was there, he was not there when I entered the Fed, but he was a great business cycle.
When you were at the Dallas Fed?
Yes. William McChesney Martin was chairman when I entered, and then Arthur Burns was. In those days, they viewed inflation by the following three phrases. They called it a money, price, wage spiral. In other words, money growth accelerates without an offsetting change in velocity. This shifts the aggregate demand curve upward. The price level rises, and then wages follow. Hmm. None of the great classical economists, including people that were pure business cycle economists, said that inflation starts with wages. It starts with money. Money moves upward, prices level rise, and then all other factors of production follow it, whether it's wages or land or what have you. And the Federal Reserve currently, by focusing on the Phillips curve, does not develop a strategic view of the world. Mm-hmm. They're focused on the Phillips curve, thinking that will somehow lead to inflation. That's not the way the world works.
So there's a few great points here. One is just generally recognizing that the monetary authorities are using models that you and others and I myself think are outdated and in some cases totally useless. But in doing so, it explains their appetite for fixed income acquisitions, for buying, for flooding the market with liquidity, for monetary easing, for generating all of these excess reserves on bank balance sheets. Not just to save the financial system, but with the expectation that somehow flooding the system with credit would, and increasing base money would, generate the type of lending required to just magically raise economic growth. But we're seeing that that's not the case.
No, it was not. But I will say this. Now they're engaged in quantitative tightening. They're liquidating $10 billion of government and agency securities a month. In fact, they've already liquidated more than $10 billion just in the last several weeks. And for the fourth quarter, they will liquidate $30 billion, and then the rate of liquidation goes up in the first quarter. Well, the money multiplier is currently 3.6. In other words, each dollar reduction in the base will reduce the money supply by $3.60. So money growth has already decelerated from 7 to 4, and by the end of the year, M2 growth may be down to 3%, mm-hmm. down less than half of what it was. And if they were to carry out their quantitative tightening, which they've talked about, a year from now, M2 will be contracting by 2.8. When you ease monetary policy, do quantitative easing, the benefits are very minimal, but they, because of the over-indebtedness situation, the little bit of quantitative tightening. In fact, we have two earlier episodes of quantitative tightening, one in between QE1 and QE2, and then between QE2 and QE3. And so in QE1, the balance sheet was expanded at $800 billion, similar amount under QE2. There was a very minuscule reduction of the balance sheet in QT1 and in QT2, and guess what happened immediately? The economy slowed. The bond yield dropped precipitously, and the Federal Reserve, after the most minimal quantitative tightening, had to reverse. And
another way, I mean, there's so many ways to draw analogies. Just one that comes to my mind now as you're talking is it's sort of like having, you know, your lungs are failing. I'm using an analogy, I'm creating one right now off the top of my head, which is it's sort of like your lungs are failing you, and that in order to continue to breathe, normally you need to introduce more and more oxygen into the lungs manually. And sort of that's what they're doing by lowering interest rates and by flooding the market with liquidity. And then when you see that you try to get the patient to breathe normally, you see that the patient cannot because it's flooded with debt and the interest payments are so high.
By allowing the economy to become extremely over-indebted, acquiescing to it, the Fed has essentially put themselves out of business.
So,
and except when they're tightening.
Because,
and when they tighten,
right.
They can have a big impact very quickly.
Because the tool of Fed action is the yield curve. It is interest rates. It is credit. It is the money supply. And when they have saturated the market to this extent, they've lost the capacity to do anything other than wreck it. But they have managed to do one thing, which is to levitate asset prices. We've seen a tremendous rise in equities and financial assets across the board since 2008 that has not paralleled at least the feeling, let alone the statistics, but the feeling of the citizenry. And I think that is interesting because, you know, this now I'm veering off a little bit here in my thought process. But, you know, one of the things that we also talk about on the program is the stabilizing effect that volatility has. Credit market volatility, financial volatility. It's something that you mentioned Paul Volcker. We've talked about his Saturday night special on the show. We've talked about the way in which Volcker managed to beat back the forces of inflation by pegging the money supply and not focusing on the price of money. And that level of volatility is very significant. We've taken that out of the market, and we've seen really this, a lot of perversions have occurred. One of those has been something that you and I spoke briefly about before we started recording, which is, and something we spoke about with Christopher Cole as well, which is this stock buyback phenomenon, which has also had, I think, a deleterious effect on investment and on productivity. Speak to us a little bit about that with this perverse outcome.
Yeah, well, this is a critical point. When the Fed unveiled quantitative easing, they said that one of their objectives was to boost the stock market. They made that clear. And the business managers, the corporate executives, heard that. And so they interpreted the Fed as saying that financial investments will be protected by us to whatever extent that we can. And, well, financial assets are a lot more liquid than real assets. But economic growth, productivity require physical assets. And so what basically happened is that assets were taken from the real economy and invested in the financial economy. In fact, there was a very extensive, well-written piece of research by Michael Pence, the Nobel laureate, and Kevin Wash, former member of the board, on this matter. And what they showed is that the Federal Reserve inadvertently weakened economic growth by encouraging the business executives to move into financial assets. Let me give you just one example. In 2016, the corporate sector, the business sector debt increased by about $720 billion. So I don't have the numbers in front of me. Investment in plant equipment and inventories actually declined $20-25 billion. But so you ask, where did the money go? Well, it went into paying dividends, buying your company shares, buying the shares of others, or other types of financial activities. And so the corporate business debt in 2016, the business debt increased $700 billion, and nominal GDP was only up $525 billion or thereabouts. And so it actually encouraged bad behavior. By saying that they, and in the meantime, there is absolutely no econometric evidence that there is a wealth effect, except for a very slim slice of our highest wealth individuals. Three quarters of our households simply do not have enough holdings of stock to benefit from the wealth effect.
And the wealth effect, just to sort of drive this point home, was what Greenspan relied upon. It's actually very interesting because we did a show, an entire show dedicated to Alan Greenspan with Sebastian Mallaby's biographer, because we went back all the way to his presentation to the American Statistical Association in 1959 about the deleterious effects of financial speculation on asset prices and the way that it accelerated booms and busts. But he supported the idea of a wealth effect in the early 2000s after the 9/11 attacks in order to help the economy sort of build up from the recession.
First case was 1987. Economy was very healthy. The GDP growth was 4% in real terms before October of 87. Wall Street immediately said we were going into a serious recession in 88, and the real growth was 4%.
Because they were.
Yeah, but they eased very dramatically, and the stock market came back. But essentially, what the Fed did beginning in 87, it basically began giving the corporate executives a sign that financial investment was better than real investment.
Right.
And then, of course, quantitative easing and some other steps along the way have reinforced that process.
It's a focus. In a way, you could say it's focusing on the shadow of wealth as opposed to wealth itself.
That is correct. Yeah. And in the meantime, we've had a tremendous stock market, and the standard of living, the real disposable personal income per capita, historically has grown 2.1%. And in the last 10 years, it's grown at 1%. And in the last year, it's negative slightly. It's a very unfortunate circumstance.
And that's been made up by debt. And that will actually transition us to a conversation about China, which I do want to get into, because that's been sort of how we've made up a lot of that consumption in the last few decades. But before we do, I want to ask you, from the numbers that you've looked at, the productivity numbers, how has this, do you believe, impacted productivity?
Well, it's severely if you look at productivity by half decade, starting in the 1950s, in other words, 50 to 54, 55 to 59, you will see that there has been a long-term deceleration in productivity, and productivity growth in the latest five-year period from 2005 through 2009 and in 2010 through 2004, the productivity is now unprecedentedly weak for any half decade period. Mm. It's very, very disconcerting. And the decline in productivity, of course, is confirmation that we have too much of the wrong type of debt. That's why the velocity of money is falling. What would be troubling is if velocity of money were rising and productivity were, but they're not. They're confirming mm-hmm. each other. And the underlying capability of the economy to do better gets weaker and weaker.
You know, as well implied in sort of this aspect of the conversation, I want to remind the audience, because we've also talked about the price mechanism and the ability to convey information. And I want to remind our audience that this is kind of what we're getting at here as well, which is that when we're talking about the right, when Dr. Hunt is talking about the right kind of debt, what we're really talking about here is debt that provides for maximum effective allocation of capital and resources and labor and everything else.
Debt to be effective. Keynes was once asked about deficit spending, and he said, well, if the economy is not doing well, you just borrow the money and spend it. And it doesn't really matter what you spend it on. You could hire some men to dig a hole. Mm. And if the first round of deficit spending doesn't work, Keynes said, then hire the men to fill the hole back up.
Right.
Well, it's clear that that is not correct, that debt to work has to be used wisely and judiciously. And what that means, it has to be able to generate an income stream to repay principal and interest. And when you do not do that, then basically bad things happen.
Would it also be fair to say that different economic philosophies are more or less effective in different times? I think one of the particular points about today is that we have fewer resources to waste today than we did 60 years ago.
Well, because we're so heavily indebted. I think that if you look at was there a time in the U.S. economy when government debt was helpful? Of course, the great event that everyone cites is World War II. We were building troop transports. We had people working in factories. We had a lot of people in the armed forces and so on and so forth. But let's take 1942, for example. In that year, government expenditures increased by the largest amount ever, and government spending was the largest share of GDP ever. Professor Barrow at Harvard has calculated in that year, the government expenditure multiplier was 0.6, and then it fell to 0.4 in 1943, and which means that you increase spending by $1 at the federal level, but you actually shrunk the private sector a little bit. And what was the key driving force, even in World War II, was a tremendous surge in exports. Our allies were war zones. They needed whatever we could send to them. And we also took over their export markets. Mm-hmm. And World War II had this fortuitous event. It was a terrible event. I mean, 70 million people were killed, or 80 million, whatever the number was. But during World War II, we benefited from this export surge, and we also had mandatory rationing.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you wanted to buy four tires, maybe you could get one. If you wanted 10 pounds of sugar, you might be able to get one or something. And so the saving rate went up to 28%.
Mm.
And there were several years at 25% or higher. So essentially what World War II did that made us so healthy and allowed us to have the post-war boom, rebuild Europe, rebuild Japan, give people access to our markets, we had paid off the debt of the 20s and 30s, and we had a clean balance sheet. And what is entirely different from that one example, which laid the foundation for a very strong economy in the United States for the early part of the post-war period, is not here.
Right.
Because we're trying to solve an indebtedness problem by taking on more debt. We're pushing the saving rate down when it needs to be moving higher.
We haven't acknowledged the losses, and as a result of that, we haven't discovered the right path for the economy. The market hasn't been able to clear. Is effectively what you're saying?
It's in a disequilibrium. It's in a debt disequilibrium.
So that kind of brings us to China, because China has played a significant role in this as well. We're in a global economy. The Chinese economy has grown tremendously since the late 80s, early 90s. And that has been fueled by the debt that consumers in the United States have been able to take on, as well as many other people in the export market, as well as the Chinese financial system's capacity to generate credit and facilitate that type of investment. How much attention are you paying to China? How you weave the Chinese economy and the Chinese story into sort of your broader look at the U.S. economy and the globe?
Well, we have a long history of extremely over-indebted economies. And we have the views from some pretty smart historic figures, and then we have more recent work. People don't know the name David Hume anymore, but Hume was a benefactor to Adam Smith, inspired Einstein's theory of relativity, according to Einstein. He wrote a paper of public finance in 1752, which is on the internet, which you should read. And he was able to look at the Mesopotamian Empire, the Roman Empire. And his concluding phase is that when a government has mortgaged all of its future revenues, the state by necessity lapses into tranquility, languor, and impotence. We have Neil Ferguson's great paper on empires on the verge of chaos. And he looked at the Mesopotamian, the Roman, the Bourbons of France, the British Empire. And debt has greatly debilitating consequences. Sometimes parts of a debt major empire will survive. Winston Churchill said, "The sun never sets on the British Empire." Well, the British Empire, that's no longer true. England survived, but they did not have the financial resources to maintain their empire at the end of the world. They had to have rationing all the way into the mid-1950s. But it was a very difficult time period because they were just not able to obtain additional debt. Some of the other cases were more difficult and quite nasty. The fall of the Bourbons, the Roman Empire, the Mesopotamian. And we've seen many smaller empires fail with too much debt. But even before the failure point, what is clear, as Hume was able to identify, is that when you become extremely indebted, you go into this long, slow period of decay. And that's where we are now. It doesn't mean a crisis is immediately ahead, but it's adversely affecting us in a number of ways. And we can see this in the growth rate. We can see it in the standard of living. We can see it in income distribution. We don't have enough growth, as Ronald Reagan used to say, to lift all boats. And John Kennedy said the same thing, one Republican and one Democrat. You have to have growth to lift the boats.
Right.
And we don't have enough growth. And the policies that we're pursuing, unfortunately, reduce the capacity for growth.
Do you think there are limits to growth in the long term for the Earth?
I do not. And I will tell you why I do not. They can be enhanced or diminished by governmental policy. Governmental policy is not neutral. But there was a famous debate between Ricardo, who we mentioned earlier, and Thomas Malthus. Malthus was a fairly famous economist in his own right, but he was also a demographer, and he felt that population growth was going to explode and that we would outpace the resources of the world. And the brilliant Ricardo said, well, you may be right about population. It could grow very rapidly. But what you're failing to take into consideration is mechanization, that we will be able to do more and more with fewer resources. And that process suggests that mankind can move forward over the long run. But it is not guaranteed if you do not pursue the correct governmental policies. Governmental policies can lead countries down the wrong road. And if they were still around to answer, ask the Mesopotamians, the Romans, and the Bourbons of France what happened.
But there are, you wouldn't dispute that there are physical limits to the Earth's population growth as well as limitations to the
amount of
resources.
There are limitations, but there are signs that the population growth is slowing down too.
Right, which speaks to this entire point, right, which is the fact that on the one hand, I mean, Japan is a classic example. And, of course, the debt is playing a role in all of that, absolutely. But we can't afford, in effect.
Adam Smith's great contribution was the invisible hand.
Mm.
And Adam Smith said that by everybody pursuing their own interest, society benefits as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And the events will send signals to you and me, to businesses, and when the capabilities of moving forward in one direction are turned off, as have repeatedly happened in the history of mankind, then there are incentives to move into other areas and make other decisions. And so I believe that economics makes us adaptable. It is not adaptable when we doggedly adhere to policies that are going to have counterproductive results.
Are you concerned about the geopolitical implications of the economic stagnation, and especially when you look at some of the real sort of just the rise of China, their military ambitions, the issues with North Korea, the populism and also the immigration from the Middle East into Europe and the effects that climate has on all of that? I mean, do you look at all those things and say, you know, this is a complex stew that is making a geopolitical conflict increasingly likely? Do you think about that?
Well, in the case of China, I think that they are basically in the vicinity of their heyday of power. And I believe that the Chinese economy, the way I measure it, including all of the shadow stuff, China is now more indebted than we are. And I see a lot of indications of very unproductive type debt.
Mm.
And I don't believe that the Chinese role economically will be as dynamic going forward. I think we're in the vicinity of a top. And that is going to actually adversely affect the role because up until now, China has been the main engine of growth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that their situation will not be as reliable, will be more unstable. And while it appears that they have been always able to pull control levers and reverse downturns fairly quickly, I think that those tools will become less and less effective over time.
I should say also for listeners to our show who haven't heard our episode, I think it's episode 16 with Ann Stevenson Yang, we spend the entire episode devoted to the Chinese financial system and the economy, so you should definitely check that out. I also want to read a quote that Dr. Hunt was effectively referencing. I have it here as well, which is by David Hume. "We have found where a government has mortgaged all its revenues that it necessarily sinks into a state of languor, inactivity, and impotence." I believe that's what
the
you
quote
were.
I gave.
There you go.
I just didn't have the precise words in front of me.
I tend to be prepared.
Languor is an old-fashioned word from which we derive languishing. And that's what happens. And the deterioration in growth comes first. And generally speaking, there's what you call a very climactic event toward the end. Mm. And that was certainly the case in some of these instances, which we've seen historically.
Well, Dr. Hunt, I really appreciate you taking the time.
It was a great interview, Dimitri. Thank you.
It was my pleasure.
I love your questions. And thank you for doing your homework.
Thank you so much.
And so thoroughly preparing for this today.
Thank you.
And that was my episode with Lacey Hunt. I want to thank Dr. Hunt for being on my program. Today's episode was produced by me and David Lowenthal. Edits and engineering are Stylianos Nicolaou. For more episodes, you can check out our website at hiddenforcespod.com. Join the conversation through Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Hidden Forces Pod, or send me an email at dk@hiddenforcespod.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.